little song about caffeine. Poets like caffeine, politicians like caffeine, beatniks like caffeine, everybody likes caffeine. I like caffeine. I like caffeine. It can bring you up when everything has got you down. Sometimes you get sleepy when the caffeine can't be found. I like caffeine.
Hi everyone, welcome to this week's Music Calgary Podcast, the only podcast dedicated to promoting musicians and music industry in the Calgary area. If you're a musician or music industry person with something to feature on our show, or would like to come in for an interview, email me at www.musiccalgary.com and I'll get you set up. This week I'm especially proud to introduce my guest. He's an extraordinary drummer, creative genius, and a heck of a nice guy. Jimmy Payne is one of the foundation artists who helped establish the blues scene in Alberta as we know it today. He's played with so many bands that it would take me the full hour just to list them off, but a few of the names include R&B legends King Curtis, Little Milton, Pinetop Perkins, John Hammond, and Otis Rush. In terms of drumming, Jimmy is as fiery as any player I've ever heard, but what really makes him stand out from the pack is the level of control and experience which he brings to every single performance. He listens closely to the band and has an uncanny instinct for making sure his playing hits the sweet spot no matter what else is going on stage. In terms of personality, whenever I run into Jimmy around town, I know there's two things I can always count on: a great big smile and his full encouragement no matter what wacky idea I happen to be pitching that day. To me, that's the real magic of Jimmy Payne. After all these years in such a low-down, cutthroat, dog-eat-dog business, he's still genuinely optimistic about the creative process. Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Payne. Okay, we're here this week with Jimmy Payne. Jimmy Payne is a great blues drummer, Calgarian, mainstay on the Calgary scene, and I'm very happy to have him in this week. How are you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing pretty good.
Excellent. So let's jump right in and start talking about music. I want to pack as much into this week's show as we can. Jimmy, how about let's start talking about your early days. I mean, your early days. Where are you from?
The beginning.
Yeah. What was your early your earliest musical influences in life?
Actually, my career started kind of weird in a sense, because I'm from Barbados in the West Indies, and I started playing steel drums. I played steel drums for quite a few years, actually, until I came to Canada to go to high school.
Did you start when you were really, really young?
Yeah, I was about 14 or 15 when I was playing pan.
Okay. And then you came here when you were about that age?
No, I came here after I finished high school, after I finished school there to do high school here.
Okay, right, right.
After I finished school in Barbados, my sister was already living here, so came up here to do the high school. It was cheaper than there because everything was cash on the barrel.
Right, right.
You know, so.
So you came straight from Barbados to Toronto?
Yeah.
And then what was your first taste of the Toronto music scene?
At the church playing a trumpet.
Oh, wow. Did you sing at the church too? Or you played in the band?
Yeah. It's a bunch of us. It was mostly people from the islands, because back then there wasn't that many black people in Toronto. We were talking like 1959, like, sheesh.
Right, right.
A month if I seen a black person.
Right, right. The scene hadn't been there for
yet. Yeah, yeah. So we all went to the church. So this way, actually, my career started with the trumpet. And that was something else, man. And after I figured out, like, this is too hard, I switched. The guy that was playing drums, we decided to switch because he wanted to play trumpet. I'll never forget his name, Oliver. And actually, I carried on. I just kept playing in the church. And then I started to rent drums every weekend from Larry Sykes on Danforth Avenue in Toronto. His two brothers had a music store. So I used to ride for $5. You pick them up on Friday and take them back on Monday morning.
Nice.
Shit, I used to drive my sister crazy every weekend. She and her husband, man, I'll be downstairs playing along to Last Night by Booker T and MGs.
Nice.
all the simple stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And as time progressed, you know, I started playing just jamming with other people. And
right, right.
I had
so
a lot
in those
of
early
help.
Times, you were playing mainly gospel, huh?
Yeah, I had a lot of help in my musical career. I did, you know, a lot of people helped me along the way. Showed me how to play things, you know, and
every great musician that I've ever known has that same thing in common, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's always those great influences in there. Yeah. So where did you branch off from gospel? You're playing gospel, I guess. I take it then that's where your real basis
Toronto.
Is, your roots, huh?
Yeah, that happened in Toronto when I started.
And then
playing.
did you get into blues right away at all, or it was quite a while, huh?
Yeah, I never played blues actually like I did till I got here. I knew how to play it. And didn't even know that I knew how to play it. It's a strange. Okay, I used to play this guy called Charlie Eckstein, and he played this song by the Mills Brothers called Cab Driver. And it was actually a shuffle.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I learned, when I was playing drums, I learned to play the tune Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett. See, so here I was doing something that I was just doing it because, okay, it's what you do on drums.
Right, right.
You know,
it's
a beat to play,
right, right.
Which I never used it that much.
Right.
Because I was playing both mostly funk and...
Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay, so you went from gospel into like funk and
funk
stuff.
And calypso and reggae, you know.
Okay.
So I went right into that.
Okay.
So that shuffle thing was just something, if I played with Charlie, I used it because it fit what we were doing, but it never registered up here. I didn't even have a blues record. Never had a blues record.
That's interesting. Because, I mean, basically what one of your main skills is that it's you're able to shuffle. I mean, you've got,
it's right.
However, you know, very few drummers have the same control over having as many variations on the shuffle as you. How many divisions would you say there is? Like how many distinct types of shuffle?
It's about five.
And then everything's a variation on that. Five.
Yeah, you got the Chicago one is like, that's the one that I do a lot because most of the songs is in that vein. And
right, right.
You got the Texas.
Right.
The Texas thing. And you got the backwards kind of shuffle.
And then that New Orleans kind of thing. Is
yeah, you know, so there's about five or six of them that you could differentiate through.
Right, yeah.
Instead of playing one beat
absolutely.
All the time, you could change the feel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But it's still the blues, you know.
Absolutely. So when you were coming up on the scene, so about the time you were getting into funk drumming and whatnot, is that about the time you met Chip out there?
Yeah. That was Bernie.
Chip Bernie, yeah. Actually, I'm going to try and get Chip in here for next week's interview.
I have a CD that Bernie and I did, man. Not a CD, it was a record back then. Probably was in early 60s.
Wild.
I was just listening to it yesterday.
A pop tune?
No, it's a whole 10 tunes.
Oh.
10 tunes on it was a recording that we actually did. It was a guy called Curly Bridges from Washington, D.C. George Phillip was playing bass. I was playing drums. Bernie was playing guitar. And Frank Motley kept playing dual trumpets. He was doing some of the vocals.
What kind of music was it?
Pop, funk.
Pop, yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
Things like Grazing in the Grass.
I gotta
hear
that.
One day I'll let you hear it, man.
Right on, man.
Yeah, it's...
Absolutely have to hear that. Okay, so around that time in Toronto, was there a lot of gigs happening? I mean, were you guys able to make a living playing music?
Yeah. It was six nights a week, too, actually.
Oh, wow, yeah, back in the days of six nights.
Yeah, and you went... She went to Sudbury, Timmins, Hearst, you know, small town Ontario.
Yeah, that whole scene.
Yeah.
So you played with a whole bunch of, you know, really popular acts. Is that about the time that all that happened? Like, when did you
actually
meet King
that
Curtis?
Came after during that period. Actually, I was just kind of learning to play, basically.
Right, right.
You know, like perfecting my craft, to be honest.
Absolutely.
During that period of time, I was just... Because I'm self-taught. And then you're self-taught, right. You know, like, a lot of things you hear that you try to figure out how to do it, but then, You never figure it out, but you create your way.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the most interesting drummers. Those are the most interesting guitars. Yeah. Absolutely. Actually, all my favorites, yeah. Whenever I hear them interviewed, they always say something to that effect, that this was their version of somebody else.
Correct.
You know, and then once you hear them say that, you go, oh, now I hear it. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, whether it's rock guys like Led Zeppelin, the guy was trying to imitate Howling Wolf, or whether it was, you know what I mean?
Yep. It all came from matter. It wasn't your idea.
Yeah.
It was someone else's idea that you took and
absolutely
just put it in the form that you're capable of doing it in.
Absolutely.
And make it sound, still have that same effect or better.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the whole thing. If it ain't going to sound as good as what you hear in an evil attempt to do it, it should always be just as good or better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So back then, I mean, the nice thing, like you say too, if you had six-nighters, you could really hone your skills on six-nighters.
Yes.
I mean, if you play, you know, five or six six-nighters back-to-back.
Back-to-back. You finish on Saturday night.
You're tight as a drum, you know.
Yeah, and you start on Monday again. And so that's why I said I was perfecting it at doing that period of time. And doing a lot of work with a lot of different people because I was still doing calypso, I was still doing reggae. But the funk thing is actually was the one I was working on because coming out of Barbados, we hear it, but, you know, it wasn't something that we were familiar with.
Yeah, sure. That's the same thing I lived in the Caribbean for a while and, you know, whatever pop music is happening up here is just really popular down there.
Yeah, at that time, you know, and so after I got all that together is actually when things start to happen, to be honest.
Right,
that said, Charlie Eckstein, I told you about, the gentleman that I used to work with at Daily Shuffle, he played a big part with my career.
Okay, how so? Tell us about that.
He was playing in Windsor, Ontario, and King Curtis was playing over in Detroit.
Wow.
Okay. And Curtis was a friend of his. So we went over the Friday night after our gig, we went over to Detroit to see Curtis, you know, with Charlie.
Yeah, yeah.
And we met him and everything. And he came over the Saturday afternoon, we had a jam. And he came in, you know, and I happened to be playing. We had a three-piece band, actually. Organ, guitar, and drums. The organ player played bass.
Played bass, oh, nice. Yeah. I like that.
So he asked Charlie if he would mind giving up me as a drummer, you know, and I didn't know none of this till after Charles.
Just on the spot?
Yeah, right on the spot, you know, and Charles told me, he says, you could go providing you get me a drummer, you know, which I did, and that had 5 years of that, and that's actually where I learned my craft.
Oh, that must have been, Curtis must have been working every week, right?
Yeah.
And you know, literally
we
just
travel a lot.
Constantly.
We rehearse every day. Even if we weren't playing, you rehearse.
Oh, right, right. It's one of those professional things where you get paid even if you're
you
not working,
retainer,
but you
got
to rehearse.
You have to rehearse 3 to 4 days a week, 2 hours a day.
How many people were in that band?
Well, we had your basic rhythm section, but when we were going on the road on tours, we added horns.
Oh, okay. Four-piece.
Yeah, we had like piano, bass, drums, guitar, and we had a vocalist, a lady vocalist, along with Curtis. But if we were doing touring, then we add horns to that. Because a lot of time when we were touring, the horns actually played with the different acts.
Right, right, sure. Yeah,
horn section. Our rhythm section didn't play, but whoever acted, well, they had the reception that played in the horns.
Right.
Yeah, so the horns played all the time. Us, we just went in and do our show, and after that, we just hang out and watch those.
Right, the rest of the show. So you must have met quite a cross section of people working in the band, like the people coming through the band and stuff, right?
Yeah,
horn players and stuff.
Met a lot of people. It was you know, and at that time, New York was happening.
Oh, no doubt, man.
You know, like Small's Paradise, Club Baron, Count Basie's.
You that know, must have been an incredible time.
It was. It's part of my life I'll never forget.
Yeah, right on.
You know, when you get thrown out of Canada, these are things you hear about, but then it happened to you, it's different. You know, you came to Canada to work, and, you know, that was the last thing on my mind. I always liked the guy, but never thought for one minute in my life that one day I'd be on stage as his drummer. So that was very a learning, humble experience for me, which I appreciated. what I have accomplished in my life because of that, playing wise, you know. In 1 year, we went to Europe 3 times.
Wow, yeah. Where else are you going to get a chance to do that? Yeah.
You know, and that was something I always wanted to go at least once. Yeah. But first, yeah, I was there 3 times in 1 year, you know, like, this is too much.
Well, yeah, I could see how you say where that shapes your drumming, and it shapes you not only just on a technical level, but it shapes you as an artist, shapes your personality, shapes where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, your
professionalism too, because everything is so professional, right? You go to work, your shoes are shine, your pants are pressed, your shirts, you know, like, you look good, because if you don't, you get fined.
Right. Oh, they had the, oh, right, I forgot about that. All those bands in those times had those things where you get docked.
Yep.
I could see why they did it, though. I mean, if you're managing a 12-piece band or something, you know, you get these guys who are constantly trying to get away with stuff. And you gotta, it's the only way to really make them
think about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When your money starts getting messed with, boy, you shine those
shoes. Things change, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. I've had some fines, but mine was mostly for being late. You know, getting into the gig. You had to be there. You had to be in the dressing room, like, anywhere from half hour, no less than 15 minutes before showtime. Right. You had to be in the dressing room, and a couple of times I've got there like 10 to, you know, for that 5 minutes. It depends on how he feels, what he charges.
Sure,
and I'm
sure,
serious.
Sure.
It wasn't a set fine. It was how he felt at that time.
So if you're in his good books, you might not even get fined.
Yeah, you know, if he's in a good mood and everybody's laughing and then, you know, it may slide by. But he lets you know that he didn't forget, you know, so don't think you got one over around him. Right?
So he's a master band leader, basically.
Yes, very good man, too, you know, very nice to his players. Lots of fun to work with.
So what kind of crowds were you playing to then? Really large crowds?
Oh, yeah. We were touring. I remember, like, another part of that scenario was getting to go home to Barbados and play.
Oh, wow, with King Curtis.
And I still have the write-ups from the paper.
Oh, that's incredible, right?
That's, you know, like, how good could it be?
Yeah, really? Oh, yeah.
Every
man dreams of that, having a chance to do the hometown victory thing.
Yeah, in front of the people that you grew up with, kids you grew up with, and, you know, that was something else.
That's beautiful, man. That's interesting that he was touring places like Barbados and stuff back then. Because a lot of guys didn't get hip till that, till later on, you know?
Yeah, we've been to Trinidad, Barbados, Guyana, and St. Vincent. We went to 4 places.
Right, all in the same tight little area.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, you can see Venezuela, Guyana from...
One show, you fly in the morning, you do the show at night.
Right, right.
Fly out the next morning to the next island and do a show.
Those planes down there are no joke either. If you're just going from island to island, dude, they put you on these little things that you...
Oh my God. Start rattling.
Man. In Trinidad, they've got a plane that goes between Trinidad and Tobago, you know, if you want to go back and forth. And oh my God, I mean, I swear, this thing is like a death trap, you know, and it just keeps going and going and people take it, you know.
Oh yeah. And the funny thing about it, none of them haven't crashed.
No, I don't think so. Or when they do, people were rescued or something.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how those planes, like, they're done on the very last leg, but they're still flying.
And if you go down there, that's what you got to take.
Yeah, because you're just flying, you know, you may get Air Canada, but it costs you so much you don't want to go.
Right, right.
So you take the local flight, the local airline, you know, and take your chances. You have to land in the water. But
oh, jeez. So when you were playing with Curtis, did you guys do studio stuff as well as live?
Yeah.
So did he use the same band from his live show for his studio gigs?
No. Once.
Oh, I see.
Once. Most of the time. Like, back then in New York, you know, it was like muscle shows at the time. You know, they had special guys, and that's what they did. They were studio guys. They just record.
Right. Oh, this was in the days of Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, because, see, Dahl was on a contract to Atlantic, plus he was a scout for Atlantic.
Oh, okay.
So, basically, when he go out on the road, we always, like, after the gig, we went to clubs, listening to local artists, you know, to see if they were any good to sign them and stuff.
Right, right. Nice.
Yeah.
So, that must have been fun.
Oh, yeah, that's, you know, you get a chance to walk up and go past the lineup and go in and sit down and hear, you know, really good acts. You know? And I'll hear something, I say, hey, man, you should talk to that guy. Ah, you can't sing. You know, I thought the guy was a knockout. He said, ah, you can't sing, you know.
Did Curtis put out a lot of albums?
Yes. He also sang, you know. A lot of people didn't realize that he actually sang and played guitar. He played guitar and he sang. And I got one album that he gave me that he's singing. And
people just think of him as a great sax player.
Yeah. And that's what you see all the time. You never really. But Juan R. Sure, he did. He did play guitar. He played about two or three sounds. He used to do Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
He did that and then he played whatever and sang.
Actually, that's a great tune, too.
Yeah, so he did play it like, you know, that was a neat thing. You go out and he play, and then all of a sudden he crank up a tune, he put the horn down and take up the guitar, and a lot of people didn't know that he played guitar. Everybody just thought him as a sax player.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's the best way to go, too, is you market yourself as one thing, and then you can sell some albums. If you try and show people what you're about and... You know, put it this way. If you get too deep, people pass you by. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a lot easier if you just say, okay, here, this guy's a sax player or this guy's a singer. If you try and sell him as a sax player and a piano player and a, you know what I mean? People don't know what to do with it and they just, you know.
Where do I market about
it? Absolutely. I mean, that's honestly, when you look back on the great sax players of that time, a lot of the guys, that's what they knew how to do. And King Curtis is the king of that. He had a certain sound.
Yeah.
And if you went to a King Curtis concert, then that's what you could
expect. That's what you expect to hear.
And you would get lots of it, and you would walk away just thinking, wow. And and you think Dexter Gordon, you think whatever, you know.
Back then, there was a country guy, man, called Boots Randolph.
Yeah, I remember Boots Randolph.
Man, I don't know what the hell happened, but him and Curtis, boy, they just did not get along.
Really?
And
Boots Randolph
was
the guy that did Yakety Sax.
Actually, yeah, it was about a riff.
Oh, he copped a riff off Curtis.
Yeah, so it was Curtis saying that he stole it, and he was saying that Curtis stole it. So, it was in Yakety Yak.
Yakety Sax.
Yeah.
The theme
Yakety
from Benny
Yak
Hill.
With the coasters.
Oh, Yakety Yak, don't talk back.
That other broom. Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, and they got a part in it that's like, da-do-diddling, da-do-diddling. And Curtis did that because back then he recorded all of those tunes.
Yeah.
Right? And so Boots said he did it. So for years, man, them two.
Oh, that's hilarious. I mean, I don't think Boots Randolph was really in the same class.
No, but he was a good player, but he was a country player.
That's right, you know. I mean, it was good to have people like Boots Randolph around because it expanded the profile of sax.
Yes, he did.
Any musician that goes out there and sells music to the people is an asset to the community, you know what I mean? To this day, Yakety Sax is
still recognized.
You know, Marvin, I've played with Marvin a few times in a variety of scenarios, and that's the one thing people always ask him to play. Can you play Yakety Sax? Poor Marvin. Marvin, the last thing he wants to play is Yakety Sax, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So. It's just like you set up your drums and the guy comes around and first thing he asks you, could you play a Wipeout?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I've been playing drums for 35 years so I could play Wipeout during sound check.
Yeah, so it's interesting what the things people ask for when they see an instrument. They always refer to something that they heard years ago.
And if you tell them, no, you can't play Wipeout, then he'll raise his eyebrows to you.
What kind of drummer are you? He can't play a Wipeout?
Oh, man, that's too funny. Okay, let's go ahead and listen to the first song of the night now. I'm going to go ahead and put this on, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about it for a few minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that tune was by Timothy C. Lee. What did you think of that tune there?
That's the progressive young blues folks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It says a little bit about him here. It says, Timothy C. Lee is one of the hardest working drummers in central Illinois. Along with playing in Peoria, he has been on the road with talents such as blues guitarist Eddie King. It says here that was a W.C. Handy Award winner. And something else called Microwave. Who's an R&B singer-songwriter who's worked with Bootsy Collins and had a Billboard Top 10 hit Instant Replay. It says here he's played Buddy Guy's Legends Club and a bunch of other stuff like that. Basically, he says he has a constant performance schedule and he takes out as much time as he can to write, produce, and record his own music. So this is kind of cool. We got a drummer here out, you know, doing stuff, recording, taking the initiative, touring. I mean, usually, you know, I like that. Drummers, they take a back seat a lot of the time, right?
Yeah, well, some drummers get lazy and they just want to play. But from listening and hearing his part of his bio, he's a progressive person.
Yeah.
He's a drummer. He's a good drummer, but he wants to be known as something else.
Yeah, yeah. He's out there busting
a move. Yeah, which in this business, he actually has to be.
Yep.
You know, you're able to write, produce, work with other people because... Can't be a one-trick pony.
No. I imagine this guy, it doesn't say anything about it here, but I imagine this guy probably plays other instruments too. Those are the kind of guys that don't let anything get in their way. If they want to do something, they just do it. If they want to play bass, they pick up a bass and they just do it, you know.
This is something I notice about the younger generation of players, like this gentleman here. They don't just only play what they play. They always dabble in something else.
Right, right, yeah.
They have the capabilities and they're good enough to play, let's say, keyboards or
whatever,
guitar. Yeah,
because
they're
playing all the time.
Yeah, do it and do it right without making excuses, you know.
Yep.
And I think that's good.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, if you can get into the music business, it's good to be able to cover other things other than the instrument that you play dominantly as your thing, you know.
If this guy's writing and recording and producing, then, yeah, he's definitely – I mean, you know, that's a lot of stuff to learn, man.
Yeah, he's getting involved in all phases of the music that he could get involved in.
Absolutely. So I like this guy, so I recommend everybody go check out this guy at www.timothyclee.com and check out some of his music and buy one of his CDs. This guy's awesome. What I really liked about this guy personally was he has a really aggressive, well-defined style. I like drummers that go out there and they play. They know exactly what they're going to play and they execute on it. You know what I mean? And there's no indecision in his playing or anything like that.
Yeah.
Great cymbal work. I like the ride cymbal on this. It was real.
Yeah, the guy that's not sure.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the worst. Yeah. And I also like the guitar and singing on this. It sounded a lot like Jeff Healey to me, and I like Jeff Healey. So I give big props here to Timothy C. Lee. So everybody check out his website. You can check out the show notes if you want a link to the website. And check out his CD. Support this guy because he's out there making stuff happen.
Yeah. At least buy one anyway.
Yeah, one anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit more about yourself and – Around that era, I know, like, you've played with a lot of great people, not just King Curtis. You played with Pine Top Perkins, a bunch of people,
yeah,
right?
Oh, it is. Yeah, I was just actually, I just moved from, my way to Calgary was actually kind of roundabout. When I came back from New York, I moved back to Toronto. Toronto was just like New York. And I told my sister, I said, I don't want to live here. You know, I left New York to come here because of this. And, you know, it was like you get on the subway. And if you don't be careful, you get just shoved under the subway. Like that I expected in New York. And that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But growing up in Toronto, and it was like that. So, you know, people pushing you on, pushing you off. And it I can handle it. I wanted to get out because, like I said, when I was growing up there, the city was so small, you know, and then all of a sudden, it's 1 million people, 2 million people,
right,
you know.
Right.
And
Toronto changed real
fast. And it was changing, and a lot of freaky things were happening. And I was raising my son at the time, my son Eric. And I told my family, I said, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
I didn't know where I was going.
Right, right.
You know.
Someplace calm.
I joined a band, went to Thunder Bay, then we came here to Calgary, then we went to Victoria. And Victoria was out because I was born on an island. And I know when you're there, you were there.
Yeah, yeah.
Until they decided to get you out by boat or plane or whatever. But I picked Calgary because of the Chinooks. And Calgary been really good to me. And I came here and started freelancing, getting to know people like Carl Roth, Bill Hills. Bill Hills actually introduced me to Johnny V. That's how I knew we met Johnny. And then we played together, Billy Gasham, and quite the band.
Yeah,
it was a really good blues band, you know. And
yeah, yeah.
Did that for about 4 years or so, and then that band, when I left that, that's where I started getting work at the King Eddie. Back then, guys used to get turned away from the border.
Oh, yeah.
It was interesting. Oh, yeah.
Right.
They get to Montana and they go look at their thing. And then, oh, you had 60 or something. You was like 12 years old and they wouldn't let you in the country.
Right.
So that gig became my gig because I was only at that time, I was the only person actually capable of doing it.
Right. Yeah. You had the skills.
Yeah, I had the skills. I knew about it. So
right.
I got that job, so, you know, like for 2 or 3 years, man, I just, the resident drummer, everything that came up from Chicago or whatever.
Wow.
Once his drummer got turned back, I had the gig.
That must have been amazing. I mean,
it was because I would do that, and a lot of times I'll end up going to Edmonton with the same band because they had a gig at the commercial, and then back to Buds on Broadway in Saskatoon, and then they'll head back to the States, and I'll just come
and
back.
You come
home.
Back here, right?
Right. Till my next gig come up. I've had occasions where I got the call, and I met them in either Edmonton or I met him in Saskatoon and started a gig.
Right, right.
You know, so I did that for a long time.
Especially once each act has a chance to work with you and they knew that they were getting it.
Right, yeah, and people go back and they say, yeah, there's this drummer, blah, blah,
exactly.
blah. So, like I said, at that time, you know, the blues were just beginning to start. There wasn't that many blues bands, to be honest. You know?
That's the thing about Edmonton, too. There's only a couple drummers there that can really handle certain gigs.
Yeah.
Steve Hoy, he's a guy, but they're always busy, right?
Yeah.
Steve's one of my favorite drummers, actually. Have you heard him play?
Yeah, I met Steve quite a few times.
Nice guy, too.
From working in a commercial.
Yeah, right.
You know, and seeing him with Jack Sample.
Oh, wow. That's a great
gig,
I've seen
him a couple of times at Chaos.
Oh, they're amazing because I believe Jack brings his own bass player.
Yeah.
So they got all that stuff worked out. Jack's got all those R&B tunes down, and his singing and playing is off the map.
Those guys, they've been doing it so long, man. They really, you know, him and Jack, they just got this thing that
they
do, and it works. It works.
Exactly,
for them,
Yeah, so, at some point, you were here playing. So basically, you were, through those times there, you were making a living and just bringing up your boy and...
Actually, I was making a very good living because I was getting paid in American money.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's ideal, man.
I wasn't getting paid Canadian money. I was making like $6.50 a week.
So you're basically settled down here.
Yeah.
And other than going out for a couple gigs, pickup gigs with the guys from here, you're basically sticking
close to my son came. I got my son to move here after, so I didn't want to be traveling.
Right, exactly.
So that's why I stayed around here, because he was in school and all that, right? So
did you do some studio work during that time too?
Yeah. Did a lot of studio work with Jimmy Carver. It's interesting you should say this, because all of this music, down through the years, I've saved it. And a lot of times when I'm at home just kind of hanging out, I'll play something that I recorded way back in the 60s in Toronto or wherever.
Yeah.
I'll play that because I keep it all. Once I could get a copy of it, I keep it.
One of these days, I'm going to get over there, and you're going to play some of that stuff for me, man.
Love to, you know. Lots amazing. Of it, like, look, it's country tunes.
Yeah, right. You but know, still.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the history of this place. I mean, part of the reason for this podcast, I guess part of the reason what I'm doing is promoting musicians, but also documenting the personalities of our music scene. And I mean, in the case of you, a guy who doesn't really care too much about promotion at this point in the game, you're here basically because I want to share these things, you know, with everybody else around here. Because, like, the scene here is very fragmented. A lot of the younger musicians aren't even aware of what the Calgary music, you know, the people who built this scene.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, okay, you talking about you were the foundation drummer for the King Eddie bands for all those years.
For all those years, yeah.
That's when the blues scene was being built here. And it built up quite rapidly. So whether or not, I know you're a guy who doesn't like to toot your own horn, but whether or not you like to take credit for it, you were part of that, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of the drummers that's playing now, I've gave lessons to.
Right.
I thought during that period, I taught them how to play. When I was starting, like I said, I got a lot of help. Nobody never asked for nothing. So basically, it's like giving back.
Yeah, right on.
You know, and I don't have no problem with that because, like I said, I had a lot of help. You know, I have nothing in my career that I'm mad about or dissatisfied about because it's better than that. It wasn't something I set out to do.
Right.
I just happened to stumble into it, and I was very successful at it. And thank God I'm still successful at it.
Oh, that's nice, man. I mean, they have that thing called the Monday morning test, which says if you get up on Monday morning and you feel good about going into work, then you know that you made the right choice in your life, you know.
Yeah.
For me, it's my job, man. I love it, right? You know, I work with computers and stuff, but the company I got with and long story short, it's just like a dream for me. And every day I wake up, it's like, I get to work all day on stuff I love, you know? So I can see where you guys are coming from.
Yeah, and there's not many people just doing that. There's there's a friend of mine in Toronto. Actually, I never met this gentleman. Bill Munson, but we, from my years into that scene, a lot of people I knew knows Bill. And I did this record back in the 60s with, I think it was the 60s, I'm not sure, with the lady there that, the Happy Hooker.
Oh, okay.
I told my wife about this, you know, how I did this record with a Happy Hooker, and she'd been driving me crazy to get a copy of it. And my friend in Toronto, Bill, he called about 2 weeks ago because I mentioned it to him. He's a collector of records and stuff. And he phoned me and told me that he got a copy of it.
No way.
For me, right? So I should be getting that pretty
no
soon.
No way.
That's another part of my musical career that, you know, it's kind of strange. I don't know if anybody ever heard it, but she actually, I mean, she can sing enough to get out of a wet paper bag. Yeah, but she was singing.
Yeah.
And talking about her sexual experience. Well, she was very hot at that time.
Yeah, sure,
you know,
sure,
the book was out and everything.
Of course.
So they were basically capitalizing on.
I think that was a girl named Xavier Holland.
That's the lady.
She was the author of that book, and then she made a whole.
Yeah, make a lot of money out of that thing, right?
Just talking dirty.
Yeah. That's it. That's it, man.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nope. Made a living
from
it.
You know, I mean, it was a much tamer time. I think it was fairly tasteful compared to the stuff you see nowadays. So what the heck?
Yeah, the interesting thing about that record was Ronnie at that time, he was on that record, you know.
Ronnie Hawkins.
The young, rockin' Ronnie. He used to own the cock though at that time, you know. He had the bar downstairs in his private place upstairs. guy been around for a long time.
Man, Rockin' Ronnie Hawkins, he really left his stamp on this world, that's for sure.
Yeah, he really loved, he's from Arkansas, somewhere down there, but he loved Canada.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Canada is his second home, you know.
I think he used to bill himself as being Canadian, like, yeah. I mean, at that time, right?
Always tried to get his friends to come up and visit.
Yeah, right on. So basically you were, how did you get this? This is a weird gig, this Avery Hollandy. So you were working for the studio?
No, actually, we had this band called Volume 3. It was a 7-piece funk band. And it was killer. It was hot.
Wow. Just
oh, yes. The players, there wasn't no weakest link in that band. The lead singers played trombone. The other guy, the other singer played trumpet. And then we had the other guy, Adam, that played trumpet also. And Ricky, the keyboard player, he had two Leslies, one on each side of the stage. George Phillip was the bass player. Wayne McGee was a guitar player, myself was drums. And at that time, all we played was horn tunes. Like, we played a lot of Tower Power. A lot of Tower Power.
That's hard stuff.
Oh, yeah. Then this is like the early, you know, Garibaldi is one of my favorite drummers.
Oh, he's crazy, yeah. You Dave know, Garibaldi he's just, is amazing. Just,
his left hand is just
crazy.
So we played a lot of that stuff, man, and it went over anything with a big band theme that was funk, we played.
Was George Phillip basically coming out of the same school as Rocco, that type of Tower Power?
No, George is like one of them guys, man. And he just have to hear these plays. I don't know what school he come out of, but he is just one of them guys, man, that could play. Could take him to a song, and he may stumble some way to it the first time, but I guarantee you, when it come around the second time, he be adding something.
Just nail it, eh?
Oh, yeah, he be adding something to it. He's just one of the good players, man. He actually was one of the guys that taught me how to play drums, too. We used to live together back in Toronto for a while.
A common thread amongst a lot of stuff that you're saying here, and this is something I wanted to talk about, is that a lot of these guys, it seems like they had really good attitude, and it was because of that that they were able to do stuff, to basically just be secure in themselves and go out and play with people. And, you know, what do you think about that? I mean, does attitude equal success in this game?
Yep. Attitude has a lot to do with, you know, it's part of your... If you have a really bad attitude or even a kind of screwy attitude, people might hire you, but you become a last resort.
Right.
You know, you was that guy who's always sitting there waiting, right. You know.
Sure.
But if you got a good attitude, I've known a lot of players that weren't really, really good, but they could do the gig. And because of the attitude, they always got the gig.
Right, because they're pleasant to have on the gig.
Yeah, because, you know, they know they're not that good, but what they could play very well, and they don't have an ego. You know, right. They could blend in with everybody. They're just happy to be there,
right.
and do their stuff, right. To the best of their ability.
Do you believe the quality of the music changes? Do you think that the music becomes better when you get guys that really love what they're doing and they're there to just play?
Depends on the players with themselves, because it all comes down to making a band.
Right.
It's not individuality. It's a band.
Right. You're right. Absolutely. It's the sum of all the parts that matters.
Right. So I've seen in the bands where they had good players, man, but they had trouble playing together.
Exactly. That's what I'm getting at. I've seen that a lot of times.
Right? Yeah, they had trouble because everybody wants to have their space, and they're exactly. Not willing to give up nothing.
Exactly. I've heard stories about Stanley Clark, who's an amazing bassist, yeah. And I've heard stories about him in concert where... And I've heard it from more than one person, credible people who yeah. Tell the truth and know a lot about music, where they said it was just the most horrible thing they ever saw, because it was like this big ego thing, you know. It come with a trio, and they're all fighting each other all night, you know,
and not even
talking to each other and stuff, you know.
Yeah, you know, and that, then you can't really, you may think that you're playing good, but it's a unit. It's a cohesive unit, and if everybody in clicking, you know, you're struggling.
Absolutely. You know, part of the, we were talking with Gary Martin about that too. And part of what, with their band, because they got Marvin, they got Chip. I mean, right away, as soon as you got Marvin and Chip in the same band, you've got some magic.
And you've got some stability in your rhythm
section
too.
But so far as attitude goes, you know, those are two of the kindest, nicest human beings I've ever known, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's smart thinking from a band leader standpoint to get guys like that in your band, because no matter where you go, I never hear Chip or Marvin complain about anything ever. They just don't complain.
No, but they're not. Yeah, they're willing to go. Matter of fact, and they'll try to explain it to the ones that.
Yeah, exactly.
A complaining.
Exactly. So I really dig that, you know, that aspect. I'm going to actually start playing with a band this year, and I think I'm going to make that more important with what I'm looking for than what kind of money it's going to make. I couldn't care less about the money, you know.
See, I've found out through the years from running bands that when I get players that could really play, there's always a problem. Like, take, for instance, Hank.
Mm-hmm.
Hank is a killer player.
Yeah.
He played with the House of Pain for a long time. You know why he quit?
Why?
Because we wouldn't let him solo.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you got three guys.
Yeah.
You got guitar, bass, and drums.
Yeah.
It's not a solo band.
No.
You're playing in bars.
Yeah, That was a dance band.
That's what you are.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And he quit.
Yeah, because he went, well, yeah, you know, I mean, you look at both sides of that coin. The guy wanted to do something else. But on the other hand, you know what I mean? It's a gig, and you guys, House of Pain was dominant.
Working all the time. And absolutely. I mean, I don't have no problem with people quitting bands. They have their reasons. I never get an attitude with a person that say, hey, man, I'm leaving. No, because I don't know what's going on up there. And I'm not about to find out by sitting him down to ask. I figure if he can't talk to me about it, then we shouldn't talk about it.
I agree. You know, House of Pain was an amazing band, though. I remember in Edmonton when House of Pain was coming, people would be anticipating it, and then you guys would come, and that place would just pack right up.
Yeah.
And you couldn't even get in there, you know what I mean?
Monday nights, like, it never, you know, I can remember so many times we show up there, and they say, oh, yeah, it's Monday night, it's going to be slow, and by 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
Oh, man, they had to call in staff. You can't even get around no more.
Exactly.
You know?
And that was because of you guys. Yeah. Those people would come down there. They would specifically. Yeah. I remember hearing about you guys, and then it was like, oh, Marvin was playing with you guys.
Yeah.
And then I knew I had to see this band, you know what I mean? And, of course, George Taylor, is it?
George was like a drill sergeant, you know, and I was happy the day I met him, because when I left the States and came back here to play, I found that sometimes I slip, and sometimes I slouch down. And when I started to play with George, I had to get up, which was cool. That was something that I accustomed to when I was working in the States. But when I came to Canada, they don't demand that of you.
No, sure.
Right? You go to play the gig, you play the gig. That's the end of that tune.
No one even notices.
But with him, you know, you got to do it the right way. Ain't no skipping over, no.
It's all about the details.
Yeah, it's all about playing it right, because if you play it right, it's going to mess with what he's doing, and it's going to mess with what he's doing, and everything is going to be right. But if you're playing wrong, he's playing right, then we got a problem.
And see, that was the whole strength of that band, too, is that you guys were just super, super tight. And that's why for me, you're a musician's musician. Yeah. And that band was a musician's band, so that normal people loved it. But also, when you would come to town,
a lot of musicians,
everybody else wanted to run out and see this thing, right?
See what's new, what they're doing.
Can you believe how tight these cats are?
How, you know, because, and that was all George.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't all George. Everybody was, but I know what you mean. George had that presence.
He's
amazing.
You flip, or you know, you stumble. He'll accept that. But if you come around and stumble again, no.
No, yeah, for sure. But the nice thing, like you said about George, I mean, here's what I like. I like band leaders who demand that same level of excellence from
every
themselves,
night.
Right?
Yes, right.
So he was putting it out, and I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, that's what all the great bands were.
Yeah.
Jim Brown's bands, all those, you know, basically those guys knew their role. There was no improvising in those bands. Everything was written
cut
note for note.
Right there for you. This is what you do. This is what you
do. That's right.
And then by the time it all falls together, it sounds so tight and so good. But it's not as complicated as it sounds.
No, absolutely not. You know, one of the most amazing tight band moments I ever saw was a James Brown concert where he was getting the band to play a little bit quieter in increments. So he was telling them, you know, a little bit quieter now, a little bit quieter. And they're bringing it down, teeny bit. And they're playing it. You could just barely hear it. But the control, right? It was all the same. The bass player, the guitarist, the drummer, the horn, they all came down at the same rate. And then they brought it back up. And the place went nuts, man.
Yeah. That's good control, because usually when a band comes down, there's still one guy too high.
That's right. And that's why I'm saying this was a 12-piece band. Yeah. This was live, I think, from the Apollo. It's a famous videotape. Yeah. And just, they were so incredibly tight. And so, anyways, it's a trade-off from being able to improvise in a band to playing like that. Yeah. So the drill sergeant thing, I could see it's a blessing and a curse. Because no one likes to be...
confined
when you
to
make
marks.
A mistake, you don't want somebody saying, hey, you made a mistake. Yeah. But on the other hand, at the end of the day...
It makes you conscious of what you're doing. You know? Every time you sit down to play, your mind don't be drifting nowhere.
That's right. And I mean, that band was one of the dominant funk bands on the scene, period. So it paid off. I mean, people knew you. The name House of Pain...
makes it easy to get
people
work.
Were buying your CDs, trying to find your website. I mean, just everything, you know.
And the band is still going under a different name, but they're doing just as well. They just put formerly the House of Pain, and they're just...
Oh, is that what they go under now?
Yeah, they work all the time. Stepchild.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, formerly the House of Pain.
So George is still...
Oh, yeah, George and Chris is still there. I'm the only person out there that changed. So when people walk in, I'd be the only person that they didn't see, but all the rest is familiar faces.
Right, right.
See, so it kept...
Which is ironic, since it's your name in the band.
Usually when one guy go, you know, you get about two sliding off or three, right?
House of Pain with no Jimmy Payne.
With no Payne, you know.
That's okay.
But it's a good thing for them. I'm happy.
Oh, sure.
For
You
know.
So for you, you're now just freelancing again, huh?
Yeah. And doing some work with everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
Doing any studio stuff these days?
Yeah. We got this. This is interesting. The compilation that Killing Floor Records.
Right, right.
Yeah. That's.
So that's Bob Richardson and Ray Lemlin and some other guys.
Yeah, and Tim Williams is producing it, right? Yeah, which is on. I'm really looking forward. Tim is a very good producer.
Is that right, eh?
Oh, yeah.
He's got the ears, huh?
Got those ears. I did some... My tunes are done now, but I had to redo one. He was in here, and I went in and do it. I mean, when I heard it, I knew, no, just ain't gonna get it. And he called me up. He said, hey, man, what time can you get to the studio Friday? I said, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. And we both started laughing. You know, and I told him what part of the song that I don't like. And he said, that's the part that I don't like either.
That's a good sign, man.
Yeah, you know, so we both went back in the studio and did it. So now they're working on the mix down, mixing it, all that stuff.
Okay. Where did you guys record it?
At Slaughterhouse.
At Slaughterhouse.
So. Yeah, they got their... Got a recording thing in there now.
They got their gear together and everything, and hopefully at some point in the future, I'm going to get Bob in here and Ray, especially brother Ray Lemlin.
Yeah.
So are you guys doing the Stampede again this year?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too.
Yeah, it's a nice gig every single year. You, Ray, brother Ray Lemlin, and Bob Richardson go down and do your trio gig.
Yeah,
it's an outdoor gig, huh?
It's in the bar, but you know it's kind of neat. Because we come out on our break, we just come out and hang out on 8th Avenue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But this year, we're going to have actually, last year, we actually made a CD.
Oh, while you guys were out there? A live CD?
Yeah, we did a thing. And no, we did it at Slaughterhouse. It just sat there. And this year, they decided, well, okay, we're going to sell it. Yeah, they're in the process right now of getting that ready for... the Stampede thing.
Oh,
it's just a good thing.
Good
for
them, man.
You know, you're playing in a bar at lunchtime, it's packed.
That's brilliant, you know. That is brilliant.
And all afternoon, there's a steady flow of people coming and moving in, coming in and having a drink, you know.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if you could sell 4 or 5 CDs a day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not just a matter of money or whatever.
It's
a matter of
getting
your stuff out there.
Getting your name out there and putting your stuff out there, because...
Entertaining people.
After this is finished, there are like 6 or 7 artists.
Right.
There'll be a CD done on every artist.
For each one, we've got, what is it, Big Bill?
Yeah, Back Alley, Kelly J.
Right, Kelly J.
Ray, myself, and this
Brother
kid
Ray Lemlin.
From BC that does kind of Robert Johnson kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Really good, too. Very good singer and good player, play a good slide.
Wow, I got to hear that.
He's about 23 years old, and I've been hearing him for a couple of years, and he's...
Far out. What about Dylan, the harp player?
Yeah, Dylan is on there, too, I think.
I like Dylan a lot. Dylan's got... you know, for my money, he's one of the young guys that's come along. I like his attitude, the way you notice he always shows up on all the stuff. Yeah. But at the same time, he's a nice guy to have around. He knows how to stay back, and he knows when to come forward and do his thing, right?
Yeah.
That's I mean, that kind of instinct. You don't see that in young guys very often. Nah.
Well, this is what we were talking about just now, putting players together that are all good. Everybody wants the same space.
Yeah, yeah.
And it ain't that much space.
No,
everybody
for sure.
That has their own space.
For sure.
And so you just have to, okay, well, usually with my band I do this. Well, with this band I'll do this.
Absolutely. I mean, you're trying to weave a picture.
Yeah, you're trying to fit in.
Play for the team.
Instead of trying to domineer, take over, you try to be part of what's going on inside, you know, by adding your little licks where you have to, you know, keeping a low profile and just playing.
Exactly. I think that's the weak point of a lot of young players. I mean, myself included, right? That's the hard part to learn.
It's very, very hard to learn.
It's almost like a social skill. It's almost like you got to feel what everybody else is thinking, you know, more than a musical skill.
Actually, you pay more attention to what's going on around you. Listen to what other people is doing. So that when you're doing what you're doing, you're not really getting in nobody's way.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people don't do that.
No, and it's got to be an instinct, too. You can't force that. You can't plan it out. You can't sit there and write a chart out and say, okay, here's where I lay back, here's where I come in.
Yeah.
You know, because night after night, it's different.
It's different.
You know?
You feel different.
And the one thing I love about tight bands is the way that the more the audience gives them, the more they give back, right? And that's what I love is when that energy, when you see the level come up, right?
Flowing both ways, and all of a sudden, it is happening here.
To me, that's my love of live music, is that energy. That's what I'm interested in. Otherwise, I can just go home and listen to the album. You know what I mean? If you don't have that magic.
If you don't get no reaction from the audience, man, it's like climbing a hill without any ropes.
That's right. Anyway, let's go and we'll listen to our second and final tune of tonight's episode now. And then we'll come back and we'll do the last quick segment with you and talk a little bit about this tune.
Okay.
Okay, so that was Mo Fester with the Red Hot Boogie. What did you think of that tune, Jimmy?
I actually like that, you know, because the structure of the song seems like they were playing together. Nobody, the drummer making no unnecessary crashes, no unnecessary turnarounds. Yeah. It was like straight ahead.
Yeah, nobody was trying to be a star.
Yeah, and that is what I like. You know, there was times I heard places where he could do things and he didn't. And that's a lot of discipline.
Absolutely, because you can hear he's capable of it.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, anybody can put in a crash every 8 bars. Yeah. But this cat was playing for the tune, and he had the right texture, and so he didn't disturb it. He
didn't want to do nothing else but just keep the time, and that's it. That's a rarity.
Yeah, absolutely. I give this guy a lot of credit.
If I hear another one like that within the next 6 months,
I'd be surprised. Yeah,
very surprised.
That's big credit coming from you too, because I mean that's one of your strengths.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this guy a little bit. This guy's name is Mo Fasser. His real name is Maurice McConnell, and it says here he's been a fixture on the Northwest blues scene in the U.S. for the last few decades. He's a piano player with a decent voice. I kind of like his voice. It sounded good to me. And it says here that he's toured the U.S. Several times, has a band called Mo Fasser, and released this album back then. It says here that he's got a guy named Stan Beecraft on bass from a band called Big Monty, formerly. And this is the interesting part here, the drummer, some guy named Tim Donahue, who's played with Cherry Poppin' Daddies and Yngwie Malmsteen. Do you know who that is, Jimmy?
Nope.
Yngwie Malmsteen was the king of speed guitar back in the day. He was the guy who's credited with inventing what they call Bach and roll. And basically, he was the fastest of the fast. So back in the 80s, when guitarists were all scrambling to have big hair and fast guitars, this guy was king of the heap. So it's very strange that this guy would be coming from that style, because that's basically really technical speed metal, gothic metal, and one of the top guys in the world. So if he got a chance to play with Yngwie, then he's...
What he's doing.
Yeah. So I'm really impressed with this tune. I think everybody should check this guy out.
Yeah.
www.mofessor.com. That's M-O-F-E-S-S-O-R. You can get the link to that in the show notes. And go check him out and buy one of his CDs.
Yeah. There's a lot of good music out there. You know, it's kind of tough that, you know, I was reading a piece in the paper with the radio DJ talking about the stuff they play and how they need to do something about it. This guy is with another station. He's not with your regular FM.
Okay.
You know, 30 songs a day.
Right.
So right. That's it.
Right.
And he was saying, man, like, it's ridiculous for the amount of music that's out there and what the programmers are putting on the air. He says, man, it's pathetic.
Absolutely. Well, the business has been like that for a while.
Yeah.
You know, you've got music and then you've got the music business. And the music business is one of the, filthiest businesses in the world. These guys have found ways to squeeze the bands, to squeeze the consumers.
Yeah.
And they sit in the middle and they get fat.
Let's collect the dough.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it's getting great now. I will say one thing. It's never been better than it is right now.
No.
You know, they've got the power to do it.
That's right. A lot of independent records are coming out.
That's right.
You know, and...
But the record companies, I'm amazed how badly they don't seem to get it. I mean, you know, they've had a lot of opportunities to make good and get in on this stuff, you know.
But if they're going to make good, it's going to cost some money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it seems that way on paper anyhow. I'm not so sure. But, you know, we were talking about this earlier. So let's talk about this a bit. I mean, you've seen music technology go from absolutely nothing to the point now where big studios are shutting down because people have affordable home systems.
Just right. You just set it up in your basement and you can make a whole CD yourself, get it out on the market, and you don't have to go to nobody else but you.
Absolutely. And so what do you think of this? I mean,
I think it's great. Right, it's one of the best things that could happen to music, because for years you had to swallow your pride and go to some guy that you don't like and try to sell him a product that you know is good than everybody else, but it don't fit in the scope of the radio. So they don't want nothing to do with it. Plus, you have to give them part of your song. If you wrote the songs, you have to give them part of the song. It's not like written by Jeff Healey. It's written by Jeff Healey and...
Yeah, absolutely. I remember even that was the premise behind the great reggae movie, The Harder They Come, with Jimmy Cliff. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. He was a young guy coming up, and he had a tune, and it was a hot tune, and the guy offered him $20, and you sign over the rights, and he said no, and he went away, and then he ended up having to come back
and
take the $20, you know, and he was
Yeah. He needed a 20 bucks.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember there was a great scene in that movie where there was guys, they had a singing group, and they would stand outside the gate of the record company every day, and the record guy would come in they would sing what, you know, he'd stop just barely for 1 second in the road, and they'd start singing, and he'd either say yes or no and just drive off. I mean, it was really, like you say, really dehumanizing, demoralizing time, you know? The music was nothing but this product, almost like a chicken making eggs on a poultry farm.
That's it. You're good until you stop giving eggs.
Yeah. And now, like you say, it's an interesting perspective, actually, Jimmy. You know, I never thought of that, but you're right. It does bring a whole new level of dignity to recording. Now you're sitting at home, and you've got control. If you want to take a week to do that or you want to take a month, it doesn't matter to anybody but you.
And the thing about it is you can do it to the best of your ability because you really want to sell this product. It's not a fly-by-night operation where you can just try to get it out there for what.
Absolutely.
You can work with it. You can get help with it because you know if it's a good product, it's going to be played on the air.
Absolutely. You know, the funny thing, too, is, though, that there's a kind of a weird reverse curve with the usage. As more and more home studios became available, less and less records started coming out. And it's an interesting thing, and people talk about it, but what I understand about it, because I got into the recording thing and everything, is that there's a learning curve. So you will get a dip in the amount of records that comes out, but that's going to stop. In about 4 years or 5 years after that, you'll see way, way more good stuff coming out.
Starts all over again.
But, you know, there is interesting arguments about this, and I'll see what you think about this. In the days of the classic records, the Stairway to Heaven, the James Brown, I Feel Good, whatever... Yeah. Part of what drove the recording sessions was there was limits to the technology, and so you had to have your songs really tight, and you had to make decisions. You had to say, okay, that's how the drums are going to be. Now mix them down. Let's go forward to the next step and do the guitars.
Yeah.
Nowadays, with this so much flexibility that you're able to keep everything until the last moment,
and
I've noticed that the songs don't get built as strong.
No, because you're making these last-minute decisions that you should have made a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so in a way, when I record digitally, what I'm trying to do in a lot of cases is I try and force myself to make those decisions early on. Drums is a great example. I mean, you got to put your drums... If you're doing a studio tune, not a live tune, you've got to put them in concrete from step one.
Because that's your basement.
Absolutely.
And if that got any kind of cracks or anything in it, the building ain't going to be good.
Absolutely. And if the song isn't built around that, then what are you doing? You know what I mean? Yeah. A lot of times I hear guys recording, and it's not to criticize them. They're just learning. But, you know, it almost sounds like they're not even listening to the drummer. It almost sounds like they expect the drummer to listen to them and fit into what they're doing, which is, you know, kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
But what do you think of that? What do you think of this dip? I mean, so more and more people have studios, and now less and less records are coming out.
Well, like you say, everybody's regrouping, which they have
to. Yeah, that's what I think, too.
They have to. Like, we can't do this no more because it ain't working.
No, that's right. And we're all becoming engineers now.
Yeah, so we have to stop and figure out a plan to work with this or conquer it.
Why not? Exactly. You know, I remember when people first said Pro Tools, as though it works itself.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't work itself. It's like the difference between a power saw and a saw. You still got to get out there and saw the wood.
It's the human touch.
And engineering, I mean, we've got great tools nowadays. You can get good monitors and good mics and everything for cheap. But the basic principles of engineering, you know, understanding how to EQ things, how to pan them, and how to get the space in the recording without making it sound unnatural. They're the same since 1960, those same principles.
That's right, I agree with you with the spacing to let the music breathe, you know.
Yeah.
Just where. Read Neil Young. Yeah, Neil Young Shaky.
Okay.
I read his autobiography, you know, and.
Oh, wow.
It's great. It's a great book.
He's an interesting cat. He's been in a lot of places and done a lot of stuff.
I was glad I got that book because. The guy's a pioneer, man.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a true original, too. I mean,
yes. And, you know, like his recordings, he was talking about things that he did that he know wasn't good. And he actually is the one that screwed him up. Because he do a gig and he get home and he's doing this album. And after the gig, he just go out to the studio and he's listening and he start hearing things that's not really there. And then he start adding more stuff.
Yeah.
And by the time he's finished... He tried to figure, well, why does it sound this way?
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's exactly what it's like when you first get working in the studio on your own.
Yeah.
For sure.
So that you know, the albums that they say were bad, actually he admitted they were bad. And he knew that was the thing. He knew what he did to make them that way.
Yeah, right on.
Because, absolutely. You know, you start adding too many instruments. And by the time he did get to the finish, what he thought was basically the finish, man, he had like...
Nothing could stand out.
Yeah, nothing that's really, because it just sounded like a bunch of banging and whacking.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that was a learning process for him.
Well, the interesting thing about him, too, because he's a guy who had access to the best studios in Canada at one point.
Yep, yeah.
I mean, he was in the real deal, and he had, I imagine, quite decent budgets, and he's probably worked with all the greats.
All the good. Oh, he... You know, it's, if you ever see that book, Shaky, check it out.
I will.
It's really a good insight to the guy, other than what you hear him doing on his music. Like, you know, with his son, he had that son that was sick, you know, and his personal life, things with his band.
Oh, he's had all kinds,
Yeah, you know, and this is a neat thing, and the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young stuff, you know, all of that is in the book.
I'm going to check that
out. And it didn't hide nothing.
You know, one thing I really liked about him was, I remember, I think it was Cinnamon Girl, he does a guitar solo that's one note, basically, just over and over for bars and bars and bars, which to me, it takes big balls to do something like that. But he pulled it off and it was so rock and roll. Yeah, and so here in my respect with that, that's what amazes me, of course, is how so many guys keep playing the same stuff over and over. I'm always listening for the guy who's trying something different.
Add something to what?
Exactly. Yeah.
That takes us back to what we were talking about, creative people. You know, there's some guys that be sitting down playing and their mind are moving faster than their fingers.
Yeah, well, that's typical.
You know,
guitar.
Like his creative mind, like he's saying so much stuff, and he's getting overcrowded.
Oh,
he
can
blow up anytime.
Yeah. Oh,
and
sure.
It's all melodic. It's all good.
Yeah.
But that's part of his thing. You know, he's one of those guys that thinks while he's playing. He know what he's doing, and he's thinking about, and he's hearing stuff that he could add.
Right.
At
right.
a certain point, that ain't gonna interfere with nothing. You know, and that's the thing about people that listen when they're playing and those that just play.
Right on. So let's talk about that aspect a little bit. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, that's part of being around, paying attention, instead of doing your own thing and figure out, follow me.
So it's an ego thing, really.
Yeah. You know, guys that usually, all the people I know that play that way, they're older.
Right.
And they've been in the music business a long time. And they'll tell you, like, you know, like, this is something that I've been working on all my life.
Right.
Playing less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's so neat. I notice it now in my playing. A lot of times... where I would hit the bass drum on 2 and 4, a lot of times the bass drum will only hit on 4.
And if it says the right thing, then that's
yeah,
all that
because
matters.
The 2 is getting in somebody's way. So instead of hitting the snare and the kick, I just hit the snare. So you get the snare. So now when you get to the 4, that's the handy bar. So that's when I add the kick then.
And you just do this by instinct when you're playing.
Yeah, because that's what I'm hearing.
Right.
This is what I'm hearing. If I hit, like, you know, like, boom, bat, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's... And then as the song gets, you may add that too back in at a certain part of the
sure.
sound. But a lot of times you could do that. And then you're playing, especially with quarter notes.
Well, see, that I tell you, that's one of the things I really love about hearing you play is you're really in tune with everybody else in the band, in the room, everything. It's almost like you're using all your energy to listen. And the playing is just, it's
fits
just
right
happening,
in.
You yeah. know what I mean? As a result of that.
Yeah.
I love that. Marvin's the same way, you know, I mean, Marvin's one of those guys, if you're playing with him as a drummer, you can feed him ideas. And he's playing melodic ideas, but he's still listening to you
he's
and
listening.
Incorporating your rhythms. Yeah.
Because that's like his guide, you know, like, I'm not going to listen to the bass player, I'm going to listen to the drummer because I know the type of guy he is. Some people say, okay, I listen to the bass player because I know what type of guy he is.
Absolutely.
You know, so you pick an instrument, which is usually the bass or drums, and that's where you go.
Absolutely.
And you work with that, you know.
So do you see a lot of the young guys coming up with having this skill? Like you say, you said mainly you see older people having. Do you see the potential? Is more what I should say in these.
Some, yes. There's less
than before.
Yeah.
Do you think it's getting rarer?
There's still more. There's way more.
More
guys are still not getting the concept of playing less.
Right. That's what I meant. So things are getting worse.
In a sense, because that's a young man's fancy. Unless somebody sit him down and tell him you can't play that much and explain to him why you can't play that much.
Absolutely.
He will do it.
I think it's also to do, though, with the way society has become more. Yeah, people are more self, you know, focused.
Centered.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I want to be up there.
Exactly. So I think it's harder to find a group of guys who want to play for the song. You know?
Yeah, it comes down to like an ego thing. Now, all of a sudden, you know, oh, I'm in the band, so I got to be heard.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
That's not necessary. They could see you. They know you're there.
That's a good message, Jimmy. That's the absolute best message you could pass on. You're building something for the band.
Like we said before, it's a unit. We're a band. And the better we could play together as a band, the more successful we are going to be.
Well, the next time I'm playing with a band, I'm going to keep that in mind. Jimmy, it was great having you in here. You're one of my favorite guys here in Calgary, and hopefully when you guys get your albums and stuff done, come back and promote.
Love to.
We'll play some tunes off, you know what I mean? And we'll get you some stuff up on the web, whatever you need done. You can count on me for anything.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate it.
And thanks for sharing your experiences and your knowledge and your advice with us. You know, I can't thank you enough for coming in. If people want to catch you around town right now, where can they catch you?
Actually, we're going to... I forgot. I have a gig, not this weekend, a coming weekend, but we got stuff coming up, like we got the Blues Festival.
Right, you got the Blues Festival.
We got the Blues Festival. We have another night in Strathmore down there.
Is that with Brother Ray?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got the Blues Festival coming up with Brother Ray. You're playing Stampede with Brother Ray.
Yep, Stampede, and then we got we go to a one night in Bow Island.
Okay. And that'll be nice.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And a one-nighter in another place somewhere around here.
So basically when Ray's going out and doing gigs on his solo name, you're there.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yeah, you see, we have come to the conclusion after sitting around and notice how the music scene is and being around it for so long, we decide... We can play, but we can play with the people we want to play with. Simple as that.
The money's the same wherever you go anyway.
Yeah, the money is not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
The music is more the issue. It's not how much money I can make. It's, am I going to have any fun?
Yeah, right.
Am I going to have fun tonight?
Right.
Yeah. $50, I'm going to have fun. $100, I'm going to have fun. Whatever. But that's the concept now. Instead of being missionaries, you know, going and getting the money and then moving on to the next gig, no. No, it's strictly when we're playing for people to pay, you know, good music.
Yeah, that's great, because that comes out in the music, man.
Yeah, you know, there's nobody up there with an ego.
Yeah.
Trying to fill that ego. It's just four guys sitting around playing music, having fun.
That's nice. Who's the fourth guy on that gig?
Sometimes you, Dylan.
Dylan, oh yeah, well he's that's an absolutely great band. I mean, you guys can just get up there, play, have fun.
Yeah.
Bob Richardson is probably one of the funnest guys to hang out
easy,
with.
Such
ever.
Easy, such easy. But this is the thing, you know, we all have been to, we have a lot of fun because we went to a lot of stuff together.
Long history,
a lot of stuff with our own personal like that. We all know about.
Right.
You know, so
you're
it's
friends.
Not, yeah, we've been friends for so many years, and we have seen the ups and downs in everybody's life.
Yeah, right.
And the music scene. So we decide we're at that age where we don't have to make it a living no more. We make some money at it, and we're happy with it, and that's that. We go out and do it, get the money, enjoy ourselves. That's it.
Nice, because then when you do that, I know the audiences respond because they can hear that enjoyment in the music.
And the music. And it's been working for us, man. We've been getting hired.
Oh, of course. You guys are, you know.
People have been hiring us. Great. And the funny thing about it is this, we are not calling a lot of people. Most of the gigs people call us. All their referrals, other people said, we'll call, you know, called Jimmy O'Reid, you know, they got a little band together.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, a lot of people, they're dealing with the younger bands and it's hard to get the quality out of them. I mean, they're good bands and stuff and they're great kids, but I mean,
they don't have that rep.
That's right.
Yeah, the guy don't want to send you to a job that he knows come Monday morning you can get a phone call telling how the room was all busted up. And
that's right.
You acted like a bunch of, you know, kids. They're looking for people to come in and play and have a good time.
Yeah, that's right. Who they can count on.
Yeah.
I know Gary Martin even got a gig like that where, you know, they hired a young band for a Thursday and Friday and then had them guys in for Saturday because that was their, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So
two is enough.
That's right. They just want to make sure that they've, for the important nights, they've got the right bands there.
Yeah, because you know your clientele and you know what these guys play, you know what this guy play. You figure he's the best bet.
Absolutely.
To hold your people, I said, to this guy.
Absolutely.
You know?
Well, I'm going to get out to one of these gigs and see you sometime soon. And you'll come back and promote as soon as you get your compilation and your album done.
We'll have right all you back guys here. In.
Yeah.
Actually, all three of us will come in. Ray, Bob, and myself.
Absolutely. I'm set up for that now.
Yeah.
And actually, what I want to do, too, once I get moved is have you and Chip in at the same time.
Oh,
so
yeah,
we'll do that. We'll have a meeting of the minds. Anyhow, Jimmy, thanks very much for coming
out.
Hey,
thank
you.
We'll
see you soon.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. I definitely enjoyed having Jimmy in the studio. The part you guys didn't get to hear is where Jimmy sat down at my modest drum kit on the way out and proceeded to kick out some monster grooves. It was awesome. Anyhow, if you haven't heard Jimmy play, then make sure to get out to one of the Brother A. Lemlin shows when you get a chance and check him out. They'll be playing the upcoming Blues Festival here in Calgary, as well as the Calgary Stampede, and they can generally be seen playing around town in one club or another. I'm also working on a project to film some instructional DVDs with Jimmy. So check back at www.musiccalgary.com from time to time if that interests you. Thanks for listening to this week's Music Calgary podcast, the only podcast dedicated to promoting musicians and music industry in the Calgary area. If you're a musician or a music industry person with something to feature on our show, or you'd like to come in for an interview, email me at www.musiccalgary.com and we'll set it up. This is Corey Milner from Music Calgary. Have a happy Easter and a great week, everyone. This podcast, copyright 2006, musiccalgary.com. This show is released under a Creative Commons licensing agreement and may be freely shared or redistributed as long as you maintain the credits and don't modify the content. For more info on the Creative Commons licensing agreement, visit the show notes at www.musiccalgary.com. Music featured on this week's show is also shared under a Creative Commons licensing agreement. For more on that license, please visit podsafeaudio.com. The artists and songs featured on this week's podcast were I Like Caffeine by Tom Cote, Some Things Never Change by Timothy C. Lee, Red Hot Boogie by Mo Fesser, and Feel My Pain, Miss Jane by David Henderson. Visit our show notes for web links to the artists' websites. And if you like what you hear, please show your support for independent music and buy a CD.